It's poverty.
It's crime.
Unemployment.
Corruption.
Accountability.
The energy crisis.
Inflation.
We are worried.
That South Africa has myriad problems on all fronts is a given. But the time has come for us to look for real solutions. I'm Jeremy Maggs, and this MoneyWeb podcast will discuss those solutions on how South Africans can solve problems by having tough conversations and drawing on the insights of South Africa's top business leaders. Welcome to Fix SA. Now, Ian Furr is a well-respected South African entrepreneur with a remarkable business pedigree. He's probably best known for founding Sorbet, the nationwide beauty chain that really did revolutionize customer service in that industry. But he's also a seasoned expert in corporate culture, in leadership and transformation. And he has long championed inclusive business practice. Now, together with co-author Nina de Klerk, he has written a book called The Human Bridge, Racial Healing in South Africa. I think it's fair to say it's an important book. It's thought-provoking, and it delves into the deep socioeconomic divides rooted probably in colonialism and apartheid, but well into the 2000s, and offers insights on how the nation can heal from what he terms multi-generational wounds. So on this episode of Fix SA here on MoneyWeb, we're going to explore pressing issues plaguing our country from that perspective and hopefully discuss some solutions that could help South Africa move forward. Ian Furr, a very warm welcome to you and thank you so much for talking to us. Right at the beginning of the book, you quote Mahatma Gandhi and you write this: our ability to reach unity in diversity will be the beauty and the test of our civilization. We're not quite there yet, are we?
No, not quite. Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me today. Not quite, no. I think we have a journey still to travel as far as that is concerned.
And what's that journey, Ian, going to look like? Because we have traversed some of that road in the past, and it's been difficult. It's been hard. People have really struggled.
Yes, indeed. It is a difficult conversation to have and a difficult topic to discuss. But I think We need to recognize that we can't simply put the past behind us. I think that lies at the heart of this book. We can't put it behind us and kind of ignore it and sweep it under the carpet and hope that it will just go away by itself. You know, after 300 years of systemic racism, we're still recovering from the psychological effects of the so-called hierarchy of human value, you know, that widespread centuries-old belief that some people and groups of people are innately more valuable than others and therefore more deserving of the rights and benefits that are afforded by a democracy. So creating the conditions for equitable opportunity means cultivating a deeper capacity to see ourselves in one another while working to transform everything, the systems, the structures, the manifestations of this devastating belief that has really crippled our society and still continues to do so.
And Ian, often very difficult, whether it's in the business sense or whether it's just in a personal peer group sense, to look into that rear view mirror. It's so much easier, isn't it, just to airbrush the past, which is what so many of us do.
And that is where we make the mistake, Jeremy. It's really about recognizing the need to talk about it. There are two key sort of elements of that. One is to educate yourself as an individual and in business, of course, as well, because most of my experience, of course, is in business through my own businesses and through consulting to other companies. But to educate yourself in terms of the history of this country, because I strongly feel that most people in the country do not fully understand or have learned about the extent of the damage that was caused by this systemic racism, and in particular the psychological damage, where you have this belief that some people are superior to others, and of course some people are inferior. So if you've been told, as Steve Baker says, if you've been told for 300 years that you're inferior, then you will start to believe that. Then it impacts on your ability to perform in business and to behave like a normal human being. So he says, you know, the greatest weapon in the hands of the oppressors was the minds of the oppressed. And that's really what has happened, is that the systemic racism and the apartheid system and the colonialism and all of that put together has created that psychological damage. And if we don't address it, it will just remain under the carpet and rear its ugly head in all kinds of different ways. Because race in South Africa right now, race touches virtually every aspect of our lives. As much as we don't like to think about it, it really does. There's not much that happens in this country that is not impacted in one way or another by race.
So, Ian, how, and let's perhaps look at it in the business confines, if we can, how does an organization or how does business leadership start to seed that difficult conversation without it becoming too damaging to an organization where entrenched positions then become hostile?
Yes, indeed. So I've been working on this now for some time with my clients, and we have what we call racial healing circles. It does take some courage for an organization to start these practices because they require courageous conversations because they will be sensitive. But if it's handled correctly and facilitated properly, people start to realize, wow, I didn't know that. I didn't know this about my history. I didn't know really about the Bantu Education Act or the Native Land Act and the psychology behind all of this and the impact that it's had. And so we're finding that people are saying, gee, you know, if only I had known about this, I would have had a different perspective. So that's what we have to do. We have to find companies and CEOs and corporates who have the courage to face this thing and to start talking about it and having these deep conversations within organizations. And there are some of them that are starting to do that, and that's where we're doing our work.
Difficult, of course, to find that courage sometimes and then to embark on the process and to make sure that it's properly facilitated or mediated.
Yeah, but I think the critical thing is we need the discomfort. You know, discomfort is the birthplace of change. If people are comfortable all the time, then there's no need for change, and then we're not going to be able to do anything and be talking about this in another 10, 20, 30 years' time. We'll still have this problem. So it's really about creating the discomfort, but doing it in a way that makes people feel, okay, I think I need to challenge my own paradigms. I need to understand my history. I need to understand why I think the way I do, why I behave the way I do, etc., etc., and how can I possibly change some of these paradigms and become a different person and make a contribution to racial healing in South Africa.
And Ian, practically, how does one manage that conversation, and are you heading towards some kind of resolution or end goal?
Yeah, the end goal is just a better understanding of people. There's obviously no sort of utopia here, and you know, and it's a process over time. It took us 350 years to get into this mess. It's not going to take a few years to get out of it. So we have to recognize that it is a long journey, and it starts with one person at a time. It starts with me as an individual. What can I do to make a difference, even if it's one person at a time? And the first thing, as I said, is educate yourself, understand the issues. And then the second thing is interaction with people who are different to you. You need to have the conversations, you need to tell the stories, you need to learn. Because you can never learn when you are speaking. You can only learn when you are listening. And listening to learn and understand rather than listening to deny and defend, which has been a pretty common practice. So understanding what I call the book of rules, which is all the paradigms that you've learned over your lifetime, you know, starting from your parents and your schooling and your social conditioning and all of those things, learning from those things, you create a book of rules, and your behavior is dictated by your book of rules. So if you can understand what are the things that are potentially blocking your way forward, and you can start to look at those and try and overcome them and understand where they come from. That's what we try and do. We get people to do a lot of self-introspection, self-awareness, and try and find ways to be able to change those paradigms and to start behaving in a different way. And interacting with people that are different to you is definitely one of the things that we have to do.
And in terms of that journey, how do you deal with the inevitable conflict and rancor that is going to stem from it?
Yeah, look, I think people are afraid of it, and that's why they don't want to do it, is they feel a sense of being overwhelmed, of sensitivity, you know, what can I do? I wasn't there. Don't blame me for the sins of my fathers, etc., etc. And we have all kinds of challenges there. A lot of young white people feel that they are now being victimized because of the past, and they weren't there, and they weren't the perpetrators. And they'll come to me and they say, but what about us? We now can't get jobs, and we can't get this, and we can't get into university, etc., etc. And it wasn't our fault. And I'd say to them, yes, in fact, you're right. You know, you weren't the perpetrators, and it wasn't your fault. But you were the beneficiaries of this thing. You were the beneficiaries. So you need to understand that, and there's going to have to be some kind of compromise. South Africa is still the most unequal country in the world. I'm sure you're aware of that. And so we also rank number 61 out of 65 on the productivity rankings, the world productivity rankings. So you can see the most unequal country and 61 out of 65 in productivity. There's definitely a link between those two things. If you don't treat people with equality and dignity, then you're never going to be able to be productive.
Ian Fur, what was your personal path to this realization which made you tackle the subject and eventually put it to paper?
Okay, it's a long journey that goes back to 1976, Jeremy, so I don't even have time to put it all down. But there was one particular incident that happened that really made me think and opened my eyes. My older brother came back from America back in 1975, and he had seen this business called Kmart, this big, huge retail departmental discount store.
Yeah.
And he suggested that we open a Kmart in South Africa. So I had just successfully dropped out of university, so I wasn't well prepared for something like that. But nevertheless, I was young and naive, and I said, sure, let's do this, knowing that I absolutely knew nothing about retailing, nothing about the black market, which was the market that we were going to target for this business, nothing about discounting, nothing about anything. Anyway, we did it, and we opened on the 1st of July, 1976, we opened Kmart. And I was the only white person there. So having come from a very, very white background with lots of privilege, I was now thrown into the deep end here. The staff were all black, and the customers were all black. And that was quite difficult. It was a real challenge for me because I was too young, too naive, too white, really quite hopeless in the whole situation. So in order to get some help, I recruited the services of one of our staff and asked him to help me to understand how to behave and how to communicate with black people, etc., etc. And he tried his best, and it wasn't easy, and we were sort of stumbling along. And then one day, it was the time of the consumer boycott as part of the struggle, you know, after the uprisings in Soweto. They had a lot of consumer boycotts, boycotting white-owned stores. And one of my staff runs in one day and says, listen, this guy Ralph, who was my so-called mentor, was handing out pamphlets in the streets promoting a consumer boycott of our own store, effectively, which was devastating for me. I mean, I felt absolutely betrayed, and I called him in, and I really dumped on him, and I, how can you do this to me, et cetera, et cetera. And he said to me, listen, Ian, I want to share something with you. I want to thank you for giving me this job. It was very nice. I appreciate it. But every day, whether it's in the morning or in the evening, or on my way into work or on my way home from work, I'm harassed by the police for some or other ridiculous apartheid law. And it's just impossible. I can't live like this anymore. And he said to me, for me, it's freedom first and work second. And I thought, wow, that was a real eye-opener. I said, okay, I'm not going to fire you. It was my original intention. I'm going to ask you to become a proper mentor. I want you to teach me everything there is to know about what's going on in South Africa from a socio-political point of view. And he said, that's fine, but are you willing to come into Soweto? Because otherwise you'll never learn. And I said, yes, I will. And he took me, and that's where the journey started. And from there, my eyes were opened, and I realized that you cannot ignore the socio-political environment in which your staff are working and living and hope that they will just adhere to your instructions about customer service and productivity. So there were two things that were just not connecting at all: what was happening outside the business and what was happening inside. And once I started that journey, it went from there.
Do you think these days, and that is a very moving and a very poignant story, Ian, do you think these days a lot of organizations just pay lip service now to the way in which their staff live, given that there would be the feeling that, well, liberation has come, we don't need to do any more?
Yeah, I think there are some of it, but I think there's an increasing wave of businesses and business leaders who are recognizing the need to, you know, to build strong cultures. I call it culture-neering, which was the title of my previous book. Mm. And they are recognizing the need now because they can see that you can't sort of be productive if people are not feeling a sense of belonging in the organization, if they don't feel treated with respect and dignity and fairness and equality, et cetera, et cetera. So as long as you're doing that and you're recognizing the need for a sense of belonging, then you start to see, okay, we need to have these conversations. And I think more and more people are starting to look at that now.
What can you tell us about some of those conversations that you've been a participant in or that you yourself have facilitated, and perhaps where you've made a real breakthrough at some point?
Yeah, so obviously one of the things that is very topical is black economic empowerment, and there's a lot of reaction to that and a lot of controversy around that. And in one of my workshops, there was this guy, a white guy in his 50s who was a senior director of this company. And we were going through and we were telling each other stories about what it was like growing up in South Africa as a nice mixed group of people. And at the end of the workshop, which takes over, it's like 3-hour modules over 3 different weeks, he came and he said in his summing up, he said, "I've realized that I'm standing in the way of progress and I'm going to step aside. I'm going to step aside and allow the people below me to come in and take my position, and I'm going to help train them, and then I'm going to be off and I'm going to start doing something on my own." So that was one of the impact, a very powerful impact of a workshop like this, where people realized, gee whiz, I need to do something about this. And that's what he did.
And to that point, Ian Furr, you write under the chapter heading or subheading, "The Moral Authority to Lead." And I think that the story you've just told me talks exactly to that. You write that South Africa is in urgent need of a new breed of business leader, human bridge leaders. These are the new leaders, you say, that require specific talents and expertise over and above the traditional leadership competencies that have been practiced for so long. What are those specific new talents?
Yeah, okay. So what we have to think about there is firstly that moral authority to lead. How do you earn that? Because you can't use the power-based authority that we've used for so many years. It has to be the moral authority to lead. And how do you earn that? You have to have the trust and respect of your people. You have to show a genuine concern for their well-being in terms of their health, physical, psychological, financial health. You have to show a true commitment to their growth and development. And perhaps most of all, you have to create a place of safety in which people feel free to speak without fear. I think that is the single biggest challenge that we face in most South African companies, is people are not comfortable to speak openly about their concerns. There's this fear. And if you can remove that, then you will definitely start to build trust and then earn that moral authority to lead. So, we do surveys, for example, and we ask people, do you feel comfortable to speak up without fear? And we'll ask the leaders and then we'll ask the employees. The leaders in one particular instance were 80% positive that they had created a place of safety for people to speak freely. When we spoke to the employees, 18% were positive about the same question. So you could just see a massive perception gap between what the leaders understood and what was actually happening on the ground.
And the reason for that is what? Is it fear of reprisal?
Fear of victimization, fear of reprisal, fear of intimidation, fear of being fired. I mean, you know, people have all kinds of fears, so they rather keep quiet. And unless you can create that conducive environment, you're going to struggle to get people to tell you the truth. And so when you ask somebody, why did you not know that you hadn't created this? And they said, well, nobody ever speaks up, which is exactly what the problem is. You know, if you don't speak up, there's a reason that you're not speaking up. And that is invariably what you have to find out as a leader and then try and build on that. Because if you just think that, you know, if you just assume that silence is acceptance and happiness within the organization, that is very, very misleading.
And then just to misquote the famous line, evil happens when good people say nothing. And sometimes it's very difficult to overcome that fear. But a lot of people find more solace perhaps in just withdrawing to the margins and doing absolutely nothing. And that's the worst approach. But one must have an understanding. I mean, often, you know, conviction is not as important as putting food on the table, is it?
Absolutely. And we come from a long, long history of mistrust. I mean, the very nature of apartheid was to create mistrust and to make people afraid of each other. So, and it was exacerbated by the fact that in those days, white, and the managers were largely white and the employees were largely black, and that just manifested even further the mistrust. So we have to rebuild that trust, if there was any trust in the first place. But we have to build trust in order to get people to feel comfortable. And that comes from the leadership. It's not going to happen by itself. You have to earn that trust from the people you are leading. You don't get the power just because of your position in the hierarchy and structures of the organization. You get your power from the willingness of people to follow you to places that they would never have gone by themselves.
And once you've done that, you've built the strong culture, which is, you've called it a culture-neering. I'm interested to know, Ian, within the business that you're best known for, and that is Sorbet, how you managed to apply some of those lessons.
In fact, the whole business was built around that particular concept of culture-neering. Although it wasn't called culture-neering at the time, we called it the soul of Sorbet. And it's quite interesting how Sorbet was built originally, or started rather. Most often, you know, as an entrepreneur, you'll come up with a business concept, you'll try it, you'll try and get a proof of concept, you'll then start scaling it up, and then you'll start building a culture once you start employing more people. But in this particular case, I had developed this framework for many, many years in my previous businesses. And by the time I got to starting Sorbet, you know, it wasn't because I was an expert in beauty, I can promise you that. So, you know, I had no understanding of the beauty world. But I had this framework, this cultural framework that I had developed over the years. And so I was going to use that in my business, and all I needed was a business to practice it. So it was the other way around. I had the culture, and I just needed the business. And that's how it worked. And fortunately, the culture, I mean, I did all the induction training myself for the 3,500 people that worked at Sorbet over the years. And every person that came through had to understand the culture, the philosophy, the purpose, the values, all of those things. And, of course, the incredible importance of service. And I always said, if you put people before profit, the profits will follow. And so that was the philosophy of our business, trying to get people to put service first and reward second.
Ian, let me raise one more issue. You talk about the rules of engagement as far as a dialogue over racial healing is concerned. There are 18 points in total, but there are two which I think are absolutely critical. One is healing, above all, you say, requires the true art of listening. We really don't listen to each other in this country, I would suggest. And the other one, perhaps a little more prosaic, but nonetheless is important, and that is to refrain from making judgment. I think we've looked at that in part, but it's the inability to listen, which I think is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned earlier on, we need to listen to learn and understand, not to deny and defend. So the whole thing is about listening. You can't learn when you're speaking. You can only learn when you're listening. And every time you interrupt somebody, you just lost an opportunity to learn something. And so, you know, if you can just really develop the art of listening, things can change. But if you don't want to listen, then it's going to be a real struggle.
And interestingly, that, Ian Fur, was also the first lesson I was taught in the art of broadcasting, is that while broadcasters might love the sound of their own voices, present company included, you've got to learn to listen. Ian, thank you so much for a very insightful conversation. Ian Fur, co-author, along with Nina de Klerk, who's written the book The Human Bridge, Racial Healing in South Africa. It is well worth the read, and it is published by Tracy McDonald. Ian, thank you so much for joining me on this edition of Fix SA here on Monday.
Thanks for listening to this Fix SA podcast. For more episodes posted every second Friday, go to moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.